about working with death row prisoners. And I'll be reading from a critique of relying on the law as a way of defending our rights and dignity from the national security state. If you want to hear this show or any part of it again, it will be available on the KBOO website in a day or two. Just go to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And if you follow us on Facebook, you'll be notified. And now, here is the Old Mole's Bill Resnick to talk with Detroit, to talk about Detroit with Ann Feeney. Bill.
Hi, Clayton. You've confused Ann Feeney with Diane Feeley, but that's okay. Now and then we all make a little mistake. Diane Feeley, welcome to KBOO.
Hi.
Diane, instead of me reciting your glorious history, why don't you tell us how you became a political activist, a writer, and all-around radical?
Well, that would take too long, but let me just cut to the chase and say that I retired from American Axle as a production worker, and I regard one of the most important things that I was able to do on the shop floor there was to help initiate a campaign to defeat two-tier contracts, which unfortunately my international union supported at the time. And it was great that we could all understand why it was so divisive to oppose two-tier contracts. Now I'm retired, and I've been active with a group called Auto Worker Caravan. We just had a demonstration yesterday in front of the International Auto Show to contrast the glitz of the show with the lives of auto workers, some of whom as contract workers are now making $8 and $9 an hour. And here we live in the city of Detroit, which is going through a forced bankruptcy. And that was a very good demonstration, and we had a number of press people come, including some of the international press.
Well, you forced me into saying some more things about you. You're also a writer, Diane, is that right? And written a lot about Detroit. You're a neighborhood activist. You're standing vigil night and day, along with many others, leading a anti-foreclosure movement, stopping the sheriff from serving notices. And you've been an activist in, almost every social struggle in the United States for the last 30 or 40 years. Went down to Mississippi, in fact, and organized Head Start schools. Diane, tell us what's happened to Detroit. Why is Detroit in bankruptcy?
Well, I think the situation of Detroit is similar to all the cities declining after World War II with the development of highways and the development of suburbia, and the fact that the plants left Detroit. They still exist. We still have two plants in Detroit and many parts plants. But when they left the city, of course, they left toxic waste dumps. So we have thousands of toxic waste dumps left in the city. I would say the factors that are even greater in Detroit than maybe other cities that we know of is the deterioration of the infrastructure, the attacks on public education. 200 schools, public schools, neighborhood public schools have been closed since 2000, and we have no control over either our school system or our city government. We have emergency managers over both of them. And, of course, we suffer from a tremendous lack of jobs. So, according to the U.S. Census, less than 50% of the adult population that is within that working age has jobs. So, I would say the two things that are most pressing in our city are the need for jobs and the need to stop foreclosures. The city or the emergency manager, they always talk about blight. We've got to get rid of the blight in Detroit. But in fact, the government is the one who, and the banks, are the ones who cause the blight. They cause the blight by foreclosures, by allowing businesses to leave the city. And then, of course, they're stripped because That's one of the ways you can earn a living. And the house is left vacant, and then it's empty. So we call, I think the most important things that we can do are develop a jobs program and stop the foreclosures. And that is precisely what isn't going to happen with the bankruptcy that's being imposed upon us.
A couple things. First, these houses. You go to Detroit and you see these magnificent places built by the most productive working class in the world, including in construction, beautiful old brick houses falling to pieces and getting destroyed. Most of them, but they can be rehabilitated. Miles and miles of beautiful homes are just being lost. Secondly, though, Diane, tell us about not only have the banks done their mortgages and done equity loans that couldn't be paid and then foreclosed and all of the rest of it, there's also been the higher level bank predation by the likes of Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank and Barclays, who loaned Detroit money at usurious rates and are now foreclosing so that people are not being paid, but the banks have to be paid. They wrote contracts where they're strangling Detroit.
Yes, that's very true. They're supposed to be first in line because they have what they call secured loans. That is, when the loans were written, it was said, all right, the money from the casinos and the money from the taxes will go to pay them first. So the so-called unsecured loans are the ones that will suffer the most. So they're actually talking about paying the city pensioners maybe 20% of what is owed. Now, these are people who, you know, their pensions are less than $2,000 a month, and the police and fire, the uniformed retirees who do not get Social Security have an average pension of $3,000 a month. But this is what they talk about. Their plan for Detroit is to cut the pensions and even more so the health care benefits of the retirees, the public sector retirees, and to end any pension system for the current city employees. They'll just get a measly 401k. So their attack is really on the public sector workers and the retirees, and they want to allow the banks, who in some cases wrote certificates of participation as opposed to bonds, which really even Wall Street people say may not have been legal. So one of the things that I think is important to do is to have the public, not the consultants, the public take a look at the loans that were given, the rates that they were given at, the insurance that we were required to pay, and to see if these are really debts that should be paid. So I think there needs to be a public audit. Instead, what we have is a situation where the emergency manager is allowing something like $100 million for consultants to come in here and figure out what are our assets and what are our debts, rather than having the community do that.
Right. Speaking of assets, of course, Detroit, like many of the other old cities of the Midwest, I grew up in Milwaukee. They had wonderful water systems. They were built to last. Detroit has had incredible infrastructure. It was a rich city run by people who wanted to invest in the infrastructure. The Detroit water system serves the entire region around Detroit. They're trying to take it from Detroit, that water system that's been disinvested over the last 10 years or 20 years, and basically steal that asset for nothing and basically give the water to the suburbs for at very cheap rates. Tell us about that, and also suburbanization. The suburbs of Detroit, there's 4 million people in the Detroit area. Some of those suburbs are extremely rich. They contribute nothing to the city. They live off parts of the city, like the art museum and the water department. They contribute nothing. It seems to me, and Detroit is mostly a black city now, it's just sort of the most naked kind of institutional economic racism.
Well, definitely. We are a 86% African-American city, so it seems to me there is an obligation of the city government and the state government and the federal government to make sure that composition here, the basic composition, because gentrification is coming. Gentrification is already here in terms of downtown and the nearby area. But that gentrification is primarily a young white gentrification. So the question of turning over some of the most beautiful areas of the city, displacing the black population, is one of the terrible crimes that's being committed. Now, if we thought about the region as a whole, and if the region as a whole could contribute to the rebuilding of Detroit and the rebuilding of the neighborhoods, because it's primarily the neighborhoods that are suffering, but the problem is racism. So I must say there are some suburbs that are even integrated at this point, because the black middle class could not, they can't send their children to the public schools in Detroit, so they've been forced to leave the city too. Also, most jobs are not in the city. So it certainly would be something that if we could have regional cooperation instead of a situation in which Detroit is blamed for what has happened to us, I think there would be a much better chance to really build an alternative that would work. But this is a big problem, that Detroit is demonized for our problems.
Yeah, demonized in the way only the black poor can be demonized. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Diane Feely, who is an activist and writer in Detroit. She's an editor of the journal Against the Current. And in the most recent issue of Against the Current, she has an article on Detroit where she discusses in more depth all of these issues. Diane Feely, let's talk about alternative fates for Detroit. There certainly is enough wealth, even in the area, much less the whole United States, to rehabilitate Detroit, create jobs. You were part of the auto workers' caravan in 2008 and 2009, I believe, was the height of it, when the auto industry of the United States went belly up and required government help. Now, they're thriving again. And paying back all of their loans. Like so many industries, they get into trouble. We have socialism for the rich. They're bailed out and saved with public money. This one was particularly successful, actually, in that it almost cost ultimately the public sector very little. It seems to me that you are calling for the takeover, actually, of some of the parts of the auto industry and the conversion of many of the plants, especially the empty ones, the rehabilitation of them, huge, beautiful, actually, old auto plants, into making of wind turbines and other kinds of, and transit vehicles for what has to be a new economy. Tell us about those struggles and the extent to which that those ideas are still alive.
Well, that was part of our demonstration yesterday, and I think that when people are thinking about, okay, what are the alternatives to bankruptcy, the idea of taking the manufacturing base, we still are in Metro Detroit. We have more engineers than in any other part of the country. So we have the intellectual know-how, we have the workers, we have the plants to be able to produce. Okay, what do we need for the 21st century? It horrifies me that last year we made almost 16 million cars. And many of them, of course, are the bigger vehicles, because, of course, they're more profitable to make. So what should we be making? We should be constructing a mass transit system, which not only do we not have in Detroit, but we don't have in most of the cities in the country. So we need buses, we need rail, we need to stop carrying so much traffic, productive traffic, by trucks, and start carrying them by rail again. So we really have a lot of work to do that can reduce the climate change. And it seems to me that Detroit can play a key role. You know, during World War II, in less than 9 months, the industry went from being an auto industry to producing for war production, both tanks and airplanes and so forth. So had we in 2008 converted the plants to what we needed, we would be so much further ahead than we are now. But we still should do it because that's what needs to be done.
Yeah, and the costs are minimal. Unlike World War II, where really there had to be a mobilization of the whole economy, and in fact they stopped making cars effectively and made tanks and planes, now there's so much productive capacity that we could be doing wind turbines as well as various kinds of solar and panel assemblies, basically to phase out fossil fuel burning in a very short time. It's only a matter of, actually, it's not a matter of wallet. It's a matter of will. There's plenty of wealth. Diane, you get the last word. Thanks a lot. We have to leave the air. What are the next steps?
Well, we are very much concerned with stopping the foreclosures. I'm active in Detroit eviction defense. Fannie Mae has a new head that was just recently appointed, Mel Watt, and we're demanding of him that not only would foreclosures be stopped, because most places, Fannie Mae actually owns the home. 60% of the homes here are owned by Fannie Mae. And to stop the foreclosures, but also to reduce what the mortgage is, because all of us are underwater, and that needs to be turned around. Also, in terms of the property taxes that people pay, but jobs is key, because half of the people in Detroit need jobs, and those who work in the who are forced to go outside of the city and work, 40% of them make less than $15,000 a year. So it's the poverty of Detroit that needs to be turned around.
Dan Feely, thanks so much for talking to us today. Keep up the good work, and don't let the sheriff post those foreclosure notices in your neighborhood. I know you're not allowing it. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Right.
That's a drum solo from Weather Report's Rumba Mama. And just before that, we heard Diane Feely talking with Bill Resnick about Detroit, past, present, and future. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and I have this question. Does the Occupy movement have a legacy? What has changed since the events of 2011 that began with the uprisings of the Arab Spring? The lasting message might be this. The taboo has been broken. We do not live in the best possible world. We are allowed, obliged even, to think about the alternatives. That is how Slavoj Žižek frames the takeaway. A door has cracked open. What was once unthinkable is now on the table, though the forces of reaction will do everything they can to scare us away from thinking about these new possibilities. But the people are not scared. In November, an avowed socialist was elected to the Seattle City Council, and we'll be hearing from her in a few minutes. Moreover, Rolling Stone has just published an article by a young writer named Jesse Meyerson called Five Economic Reforms Millennials Should Be Fighting For: Guaranteed Jobs, Universal Basic Incomes, Public Finance, and More. And the comments section gives us evidence of the panic created on the right by enticing visions of a new way to live. Now, it's this attack on Meyerson from commenters that I want to focus on today, so I'm going to summarize Meyerson's proposals very briefly. You can read his article online at Rolling Stone, and also listen to the Old Mole Variety Hour next week when Meyerson will be talking here on this show with Joe Clement. Well, now, the first two reforms are, first, that everyone who wants a job should be able to get one that pays a living wage, with the government as the employer taking up the slack from the private sector. And second, Social Security for all. No one who is unable or even unwilling to work for wages should have to do so. An amount of money sufficient to live on would come to every citizen automatically every month. The result, of course, is that employers would have to treat their workers quite well, since workers would no longer be slaves to wages, and that everyone would be free to, as we say, get a life. Martin Luther King, by the way, called for both of these programs in the 1960s, and Joe Clement read a piece going into more detail on these revolutionary reforms last week on this show. Now, Meyerson's third and fourth proposals abolish the principle that the commons can be privately owned and exploited to profit the wealthy, a cornerstone of capitalism. Thus, land would be owned by municipalities or land trusts and managed for the benefit of everyone. The same goes for capital. A sovereign wealth fund would buy up all the assets from the private sector and pay dividends to everyone. Alaska's use of its oil reserves is a model of such a fund. And finally, every state should have a state bank like North Dakota's. A state bank would not play around with incomprehensible derivatives and allow its executives to extract billions of dollars. It just makes loans and works with debtors to pay them off. Now, obviously, there are many things left unexplained in Meyerson's piece, let alone in my very brief account of it. What's important is that such ideas are surfacing in places where they have not appeared before, so that more of us can be thinking them out. But this fact has created an uproar among the staunchest defenders of capitalist privilege. As one headline has it, "Conservatives' heads explode over Rolling Stone article on communist reforms." The biggest explosions happening on Fox News. Are the defending ideologues of capital in a panic, sensing that the automatic credence given to their ruling ideas is in jeopardy? Zizek notes that before the actual collapse of an authoritarian regime, a mysterious rupture takes place. All of a sudden, people know that the game is over, and they are simply no longer afraid. It is not only that the regime loses its legitimacy, its exercise of power is itself perceived as an impotent panic reaction, unquote. Now, the panic is felt not only by the well-paid propagandists of Fox News, but by mobs of anonymous commenters on the webpage version of Meyerson's article and on other websites where the controversy has aired. There are a couple of themes to these comments. One is that what Meyerson is proposing is communism, and communism has been revealed as a failed and tyrannical system by the history of the Soviet Union. But Meyerson's proposals have nothing to do with communism if communism means the system that failed and deserved to fail in the Soviet Union. Meyerson's communism is the ideal of a world in which everyone receives what they need to flourish and does what they can to make that flourishing possible. From each according to ability, to each according to need. People imagine communism as a cruel and totalitarian system, not just because of the historical example of the USSR, but also because just imagining a system of cooperative labor and shared commitment to the community violates a fundamental and deeply felt American mistrust of the collective or the commons. The fear of others is a crucial part of the structure of feeling that holds communism at bay and blinds the victims of capitalism to its radical injustice. Well, what fear of others? The fear that if they could get what we have without giving anything back, they wouldn't hesitate. Everyone besides us and our friends are thieves and parasites at heart and are only kept in line by law enforcement and only kept working by the lack of any alternative to starvation besides wage labor. But thievery and parasitism are inevitable responses to the system of capitalism and wage labor, where your material security depends on what you individually possess rather than on your solidarity with a community that always has your back. The experience of the Occupy movement demonstrated to many folks that building a functioning community is possible, and future political movements can and must spread this lesson widely. The tribal evolution and history of our species and our own involvement throughout life in family and community activities that are cooperative rather than competitive give us all reason to know that communism is possible. The thuggish swarming of the commentary pages of mainstream and liberal websites with angry and hateful language can give the impression that the vast majority of Americans would rise up with guns to put down a serious movement for radical change, and is probably orchestrated to intimidate people from speaking and writing publicly about alternatives to capitalism. But we should take courage from the excitement around the Occupy movement and from polls showing more respect for socialism than for capitalism, especially among the young. Meyerson concludes his piece, "If the ideas described in this piece sound good to you, there's a bitter political struggle to be waged. Let's get to work." And more percussion from Rumba Mama by Weather Report. And you are tuned to KBOO in the Old Mole Variety Hour. As I was suggesting a moment ago, being a socialist is no longer something to hide, which implies that capitalism may no longer have the upper hand ideologically. Evidence of that fact is the election in November of Kishama Sawant running as a socialist to the Seattle City Council. Here is her inauguration speech given to a cheering crowd at City Hall last week. I've edited out some of the cheering, so what you'll hear is only part of the enthusiasm for the message she delivers.
My brothers and sisters, thank you for your presence here today. This city has made glittering fortunes for the super wealthy and the major corporations that dominate Seattle's landscape. At the same time, the lives of working people, the unemployed, and the poor grow more difficult by the day. The cost of housing skyrockets and education and healthcare become inaccessible. This is not unique to Seattle. Shamefully, in this, the richest country in human history, 50 million of our people, 1 in 6, live in poverty. Around the world, billions do not have access to clean water and basic sanitation, and children die every day from malnutrition. This is the result of international capitalism. This is the product of the gigantic casino of speculation created by the highway robbers on Wall Street. In this system, the market is God, and everything is sacrificed at the altar of profit. Capitalism has failed the 99%. Despite recent talk of economic growth, it has only been a recovery for the richest 1%, while the rest of us are falling ever farther behind. In our country, Democratic and Republican politicians alike primarily serve the interests of big business. A completely dysfunctional Congress does manage to agree on one thing: regular increases in their already bloated salaries, yet at the same time allowing the federal minimum wage to stagnate and fall further and further behind inflation. We have the obscene spectacle of the average corporate CEO getting $7,000 an hour, while the lowest paid workers are called presumptuous in their demand for just 15. To begin to change all of this, we need organized mass movements of workers and young people relying on their own independent strength. That is how we won unions, civil rights, and LGBTQ rights. Again, throughout the length and breadth of this land, working people are mobilizing for a decent and dignified life for themselves and their children. Look at the fast food workers' movement, the campaigns of Walmart workers, and the heroic activism to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. Right here in SeaTac, we have just witnessed the tremendous and victorious campaign for $15 an hour. At the same time, in Lorain County, Ohio, 24 candidates ran, not as Democrats or Republicans, but as independent labor, and were elected to their city councils. I will do my utmost to represent the disenfranchised and the excluded, the poor and the oppressed, by fighting for a $15 an hour minimum wage, affordable housing, and taxing the super rich for a massive expansion of public transit and education. But my voice will be heard by those in power only if workers themselves shout their demands from the rooftops and organize en masse. My colleagues and I in Socialist Alternative will stand shoulder to shoulder with all those who want to fight for a better world. But working people need a new political party. A mass organization of the working class run by and accountable to themselves. A party that will struggle and campaign in their interest and that will boldly advocate for alternatives to this crisis-ridden system. Here in Seattle, political pundits are asking about me. Will she compromise? Can she work with others? Of course, I will meet and discuss with representatives of the establishment. But when I do, I will bring the needs and aspirations of working class people to every table I sit at, no matter who is seated across from me. And let me make one thing absolutely clear. There will be no backroom deals with corporations or their political servants. There will be no rotten sellout of the people I represent. I wear the badge of socialist with honor. To the nearly 100,000 who voted for me, and to the hundreds of you who worked tirelessly on our campaign, I thank you, and let us continue. The election of a socialist to the council of a major city in the heartland of global capitalism has made waves around the world. We know because we have received messages of support from Europe, Latin America, Africa, and from Asia. Those struggling for change have told us they have been inspired by our victory. To all those prepared to resist the agenda of big business, in Seattle and nationwide. I appeal to you, get organized. Join with us in building a mass movement for economic and social justice, for democratic socialist change, whereby the resources of society can be harnessed not for the greed of a minority, but for the benefit of all people. Solidarity.
Solidarity. That was Socialist Kashama Sawant delivering her inauguration speech on taking up the office of Seattle City Council member last week. Here on KBOO's Old Mole Variety Hour. Now here's an announcement from Megan Heiss of Portland Rising, an announcement about a meeting where you can learn why several Portland unions may go on strike.
Aggressive Portland employers are pushing several local unions toward a strike in the coming weeks. This is no accident. Unions nationwide are facing Wisconsin-style attacks targeting public employees, teachers, students, and everyone who benefits from public services. After years of budget cuts and layoffs, Oregon is ranked one of the worst in the country for teacher-to-student ratios. But rather than partner with Portland teachers to find solutions to large class sizes, Portland Public Schools appears poised to walk away from the bargaining table. The district's private contractor, First Student, a multinational bus company based out of the UK, is also playing hardball with workers. School bus drivers have been working without a contract for over a year. New drivers who start at less than $13 an hour are being asked to take wage freezes for 5 years, while more senior drivers are being asked to pay 25% more out of pocket for health care. But the Portland School District isn't alone. Educators at Portland State University are fighting deep cuts to the university budget, as well as concessions at the bargaining table that threaten job security and academic freedom. Their contract expires at the end of the month. Meanwhile, at the City of Portland, after almost a year of bargaining, negotiators for city management declared impasse in negotiations with city workers, who are fighting to preserve critical contract language that prevents wasteful outsourcing and protects family wage jobs. But in the face of these intransigent employers intent on concessions and union busting, workers are standing up and holding the line, and we have the opportunity to join them in fighting for Portland's future. This Thursday at 5:30 p.m., join Portland Rising for a community discussion about how we can work together and take action for the common good. The event will be held at PSU in the Smith Center, room 238. Find out how you can support Portland teachers, city workers, PSU educators, and school bus drivers who are fighting for dignity, respect, and our public services. Building solidarity through action, we will prove that Portland is a union town.
Thank you, Megan. And there will be an extended report on these issues on Labor Radio tonight at 6 o'clock here on KBOO. Now, next up on The Old Mole, we've got Larry Bolden, our book mole, here to tell us about a soon-to-be-published novel by Portland writer Renee Denfeld. Larry.
Good morning. I want to talk to you this morning about a sensational book by a local author. The book will be published in March of this year. The author is Renee Denfeld. She calls the book a novel, and it is a novel, but one that she could only have written because of her work in prisons and for men on death row. Besides being an internationally known author and journalist, she has worked as a mitigation specialist and fact investigator in death penalty cases. The title of the novel is The Enchanted, and it begins with a narration by one of the death row inmates who tells us, quote, "This is an enchanted place. Others don't see it, but I do. The most enchanted things happen here, the most enchanted things you can imagine. I want to tell you while I still have time, before they close the black curtain and I take my final bow." Close quote. To say that this is a sad book would be an incredible understatement, but given the insights and compassion of its author, the sadness is dwarfed by the importance of the content. The lead character, who is always referred to simply as the lady, works for attorneys who represent men on death row. Her task is not to get these men out of prison, but simply to get them off of death row and back into the general prison population. The other central characters are the men themselves, a defrocked priest, and a warden whose wife is dying of cancer. The descriptions of the inside of the prison, especially of the dark, windowless hall of death row, are detailed and horrific. quoting from the book, "Back so long ago when they built this enchanted place, they killed men in three ways. They waited for them to die, worked them to death, and they hanged them. Not much has changed. Instead of working men to death, there is a slow starvation of the body and soul, and instead of rope, they use a machine." Close quote. But while the lady works with and for a single death row inmate at a time, she is not at all blinded to the atrocities some of them have committed and for which they are on the row. Over and over she tells the reader that she has more sympathy for the victims of these men than for the men, but still she in some sense understands them and advocates for them. Quote, "Her clients rarely walk to freedom. That is a myth. She can count the truly innocent clients she's had on one finger. Most of the men she works with are guilty. They may not be guilty of all they were charged, but they are guilty of more than enough. Many are guilty of even worse, the crimes that were suspected and never proven. No, the dream of the death row client is to escape execution for a life behind bars. They want to escape the dungeon into the rest of the prison. They want a visit from their mom that involves a touch. They want to stand in the sun, to play a game of ball, to eat at a table with other men, and to see the sky and feel the wind. Those are their dreams. Maybe small to others, but huge to them. It is a modest dream in a sense, and yet one that is amazingly hard to achieve for a man on death row." The lady digs, close quote. The lady digs into the past of these men. If they give her permission to do so, and often they refuse, she interviews family members and past acquaintances, hoping to turn up facts that will lead not to their freedom, but simply get them off of death row. The lady's own very difficult past helps her to realize what may be relevant for the attorneys working for these men. She also knows about the guards who profit by helping selected inmates to smuggle drugs into the prison, or by providing frightened boy prisoners for them to do with as they will in the rape shed. She knows of the corpse valets, prisoners selected by a corrupt guard named Conroy. He selects men who know how to be quiet, how to keep secrets, quote, "And the secrets are so many. How bodies end up dead in cells with signs of strangulation or broken necks, and the guards clear their throats and say, natural causes. How others are shot, and others die in heaps of blood, all erased by the dawn. How no one ever dies here of abuse, of rape, of being killed by the guards. How the records, what record? A prison is a place without a history." Close quote. But while the book talks extensively of corrupt guards and privileged prisoners, the portrait of the warden is all in all a sympathetic one. True, he thinks of the lady as an enemy, but he also really tries to expose corrupt guards and to treat inmates fairly. Again quoting from the book, "But after seeing the lady, he can't help getting angry. He takes his job seriously. Every day he protects inmates from each other and society from inmates. He wants to tell the politicians to try policing 3,000 men who spend their lives trying to disembowel each other with shanks made out of sharpened table knives. Get back to me on how it goes." And then the lady comes in, pulls a few tearjerkers for judges who have never stepped foot inside a prison, who have never even met the victims of their families, and the next thing he knows, she's walking another man away from his deserved death. He knows there are too many black men on the row. He knows there are many men who had Grimm and Reaper for their defense attorneys. He tells his new guards there are more than enough guilty men to go around. We don't need to invent more. He's the first to admit the system needs fixing. When he thinks about what men like York and Stryker and Arden have done, he is firm in his truth. Enough years of being a jailer, of seeing men kill each other in prison riots, of holding the hands of rape victims as they testify in front of parole boards, he knows that some men deserve to die. He can chat with a man like York, and he can even show kindness to a man like Arden, but he knows in his heart they deserve to die. Such men are like diseased dogs or demented animals. You can bemoan what made them killers, but once they are, the best thing to do is to put them down with mercy. He stops himself. No, he thinks again. The lady does know those things. She talks to the men's families. She plumbs their lives. She has to know the pain they have caused. Yet she still tries to get them off, and this he cannot figure. This is the part that makes him mad. Close quote. What is she to do if she runs into a prisoner who doesn't want to be saved from execution? Suppose that she has in a file enough to save a man from death row, but he insists that she not show the file to the attorneys. Should her loyalty be to her employers or to the man she is allegedly trying to help? And can she go on doing the work if she refuses, in this case, to reveal what she has uncovered? If there is an answer to her question, perhaps it will come from one of the death row inmates. Quote, I sit under the cover of an eternity before I decide the lady is strong enough to have seen me. Someday she will see the monsters for what they are and stop questioning herself about why she seeks them. She will stop feeling bad about wanting to make castles for them. Even monsters need peace. Even monsters need a person who truly wants to listen, to hear, so that someday we might find the words that are more than boxes. Then maybe we can stop men like me from happening. The lady has a gift, and I hope she keeps using it. It is a gift of understanding men like me. Close quote. This is a courageous book. Ms. Denfeld, especially given her continuing work, was so brave to have written it and to have lived the life that allowed her to write it. I commend her for her superb writing and for her courage and her gift. I've been talking about Renee Denfeld's soon-to-be-published novel, The Enchanted. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry, for that review. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. And coming up on KBOO at 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus presents Trees in Paradise, Part 2, as host Barbara Bernstein speaks again with Jared Farmer, whose book Trees in Paradise explores the connection between transplanted people and trees. At 11, Health Watch features an encore presentation of an interview with botanist, nature photographer, and writer John Callis, founder of Wild Food Adventures. At 11:30, we hear a discussion of the science, sociology, and politics of compassion. Can compassion and compassion training change our physiology for the better? Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks to all KBOO members for your generous support. You can become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now, I have a reading about the problems of using just the law to fight the American security state. It's called Edward Snowden and the American Condition by Chase Madar, and it was on... It was in a Jacobin magazine. The law is the law. A 54% majority of Americans may approve of Edward Snowden's sensational leak about the National Security Agency's indiscriminate surveillance, but just as many think the whistleblower should be prosecuted. The penalty is not light. The three, so far, charges against Snowden carry a sentence up to 30 years. But rules are rules, and despite our national self-image as rebels who buck systems and distrust government, we are, as one recent study bears out, the most obedient people in the industrialized world, and the most legalistic. The law is the law. Now, this tautology carries a whiff of desperation, as we see increasingly often that the law is not the law at all, especially in the broad realm of national security. Will James Clapper, National Intelligence Director, be prosecuted for perjuring himself before Congress when he lied about the surveillance program? How often does rape get prosecuted in the military, and when it does, how often does the conviction stick? Did the U.S. Marine unit that slaughtered 24 civilians execution style in Haditha, Iraq, face any real penalty? And yet, the law will put on a stern face for Edward Snowden, just as it did for Private Bradley, now Chelsea Manning. The purely hypothetical damage to national interests in both of these cases apparently counts for far more than the real flesh-and-blood victims of unprosecuted and unpunished crimes like torture, rape, and the killing of civilians. National security law can come down like a ton of bricks, but just as often it is ignored. In 2008, we learned that NSA staffers were listening in on phone sex between U.S. Army officers in Iraq and folks back home. This was, of course, against the law, but legal barriers were hardly enough to stop officials from using the surveillance techniques as they liked. Why on earth should we expect NSA employees now to respect legal fences in surveillance that are so easy to step over and so unlikely to be enforced? From both Manning and Snowden, we have learned how, quote, national security was actually practiced, abroad and at home, and the vivid accounts of these two 20-somethings, neck deep in war and surveillance, contrast starkly with the official statements spun by PR flacks and heavily processed by lawyers. Yet law remains our litmus test. Very often, the mightiest anathema we can muster for something we oppose is that it's illegal, or even worse, unconstitutional. One of the first reasons given for the Iraq War's wrongness, if not the first reason, is its illegality. Today, the mass surveillance is denounced by progressives and even a few conservatives as unconstitutional. Now, these are really weak condemnations. Would the Iraq War have been redeemed by a permission slip from the UN Security Council? Were the sanctions against Iraq, which killed hundreds of thousands, okay because they were in conformance with the UN Charter? And even if the NSA surveillance is ruled unconstitutional, is this really the problem with it? And what if the courts determine, as is entirely possible, that the NSA surveillance is legally permissible? If the surveillance is legal, does that mean we have to like it? No. And we urgently need to remind ourselves that lawfulness is never an indicator of wisdom, efficacy, prudence, or even justice. 99% of what led to the 2008 financial crash was perfectly legal, transactions working within the law according to legal incentives. And progressive calls to fix the financial system with more criminal prosecutions both misdiagnose and underestimate a systemic problem. Most of the horrors disclosed by WikiLeaks, like the slaughter in the Apache helicopter video, are also legally permissible, according to the laws of war as they actually exist. In fact, WikiLeaks exposed precious few war crimes, strictly speaking, but a great many atrocities. It's an ugly tribute to the power of law and lawyers how many atrocities are legal. Given the inadequacies of the legalist outlook, then, why is our critical discourse so overrun with law talk, tense legalism of the United States, a nation founded on legal documents? Philosophy is not taught in high schools, and as a religiously heterogeneous nation, we lack a shared theological language that might address our problems in moral terms. An expressly political vernacular, one that discusses policy in terms of interests and values more than law, is out of the question in a country as depoliticized as ours. How else could we talk but in legalese? And today, most of what little resistance there is against imperial violence and domestic repression, always in the name of security, comes from lawyerly nonprofit groups staffed by the cream of elite law schools, rights groups like the ACLU, Human Rights Watch, Human Rights First, and a bit edgier, the Center for Constitutional Rights, do a great deal of valuable, often brave work, but these organizations are no substitute for a political opposition, groups with political muscle and expressly political arguments. Our laws are not the miraculous embodiment of a transcendent morality. As Martin Luther King said, we should never forget that everything Adolf Hitler did in Germany was legal, and everything the 1956 Hungarian freedom fighters did in Hungary was illegal. The solution to most of our problems lie beyond the legal sphere. Is there any legal hope for Snowden or Bradley Manning? Of course not. No courtroom miracle will save them, and what they are up against are not so much abuses of the laws as the laws themselves. All legal systems have some form of pardoning mechanism which recognize implicitly that the law makes mistakes and can lag behind justice. Obama, however, has been remarkably stingy with commutations, and it is impossible to envision him or any other Democrat, or for that matter Republican, granting clemency in a national security case. The law is not nothing, but it sure as hell isn't everything. The NSA scandal shows that freedoms are far more than legal phenomena, and that any successful pushback against the creeping police state will have to be based more in politics than in law. And that's from Edward Snowden and the American Condition by Chase Madar in Jacobin Magazine. And that's going to conclude the Old Mole for today. Thank you, Bill Resnick and Diane Feely, for their discussion about Detroit. To Kashama Sawant, Seattle's new socialist member of the City Council, for her work. To Larry Bolden for his review of Renee Denfeld's forthcoming novel about working with prisoners on death row. And to our engineer, Joe Clement, for keeping everything flowing. To hear this show or any part of it again, go to kboo.fm / Old Mole Variety Hour. This show should be up in a day or two. And tune into the Old Mole Variety Hour next week when Bill Resnick will be hosting a show featuring the Movie Moles talking about Her. And Joe Clement will be interviewing Jesse Meyerson, the author of the piece in Rolling Stone that I discussed in my commentary. And stay tuned now for Air Cascadia.
KBOO Radio is proud to sponsor Keep Alive the Dream 2014, the 29th annual tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This annual event, a production of World Arts Foundation Incorporated, will be broadcast live from the Anthem Convention Center at 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in its entirety on KBOO on Monday, January 20th, from 11 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side under Community Events.
It's hard to think that this great man is dead.